Hey, everybody. This is the Pick Six podcast for Friday, July 24th. I'm Sam McEwen along with Evan Bland, who I think is, that's Star Wars 3 or what is that?
This is a screenshot from Star Wars Episode 3.
Yeah.
In homage to our Chris Heddies and his favorite movie of the Star Wars saga, controversial as it may be.
Yeah, it's a fine movie, and we're joined by Evan Bland, and then, of course, Chris Heddy, who is, this is his last official appearance on the Pick Six podcast, because Chris is going home, so to speak. Not home, but he's going back to Kansas, and he'll talk a little bit about what he's going to be doing and some of his favorite reflections of the time, and I want him to kind of give, now that he's kind of done covering Nebraska basketball, just some thoughts on where it's going to go from here, where it was, what happened at the end of the 10 Miles era. So we're going to let him kind of go on a, you know, 5-minute journey there and talk a little bit. But this is Chris's final podcast, official. He's going to be always open to be a guest on our podcast. And so long as we're doing this by Zoom, it would be pretty easy for him to be on a podcast. Chris, we're excited for you. You're going back to KU to go to grad school. You grew up a big KU basketball fan. And as I was talking to Chattel yesterday about this NCAA Board of Governors meeting that might happen today or where they might decide. And he goes, Chris is going back to watch Kansas and Kansas State basketball, and that's better than every game. And he's
right. That is the most dumb reaction possible.
It's a good point. I mean, unless Michigan State – I'm not kidding. The Big Ten basketball, unless Michigan State is in the top five and they're playing, I don't know, Indiana, who's also in the top five – Big 12 basketball is a lot more fun than the Big Ten. Like it's Big Ten basketball doesn't compare, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think the difference is that I would rather go, like, if I have no rooting interest whatsoever, I would rather watch the Big 12 tournament than the Ten tournament, and that's the difference, I think.
The huge difference, the investment of the fans and just the history of the programs.
Yeah,
Michigan State and Indiana and Michigan when they're good. Have a cool history that's like worth indulging.
Yeah,
Wisconsin was good for a couple of years, but yeah.
Well, Wisconsin's not fun to watch anyway. So
you're going back to KU. Your wife is going to K. You know, she's from she went to K State. You guys are moving to Manhattan, so you can talk a little bit about that in a little while. We're gonna miss you. You know that. Hope you know that. We've loved having you, and you've written some awesome stuff. And really interesting, like, you know, from Maurice Washington to all kinds of other things. So we'll get into that toward the end of the podcast, so people need to stay tuned in. On the front end, we're going to talk a little bit about a potential NCAA Board of Governors meeting that's going to happen today. I don't know that anything big's going to come out of it, but it might. We'll talk a little bit about Husker football going into mini camps. We'll talk a little recruiting. A couple guys did not pick Nebraska. We're recording this on a Friday morning. Tonight at 7 p.m., Nadab Joseph will be deciding where he's going to go to school, and I'm pretty sure he's going to Nebraska. So we'll talk a little bit about him, what he can bring to the table right away. We'll talk about the position breakdown from earlier in the week, and then we'll get to Chris and sort of his reflections and recollections and a little bit on the future of Husker basketball. So I think it's going to be a good time, a good chat. Yeah. Our show is, as always, is brought to you by Team Schwalbach. It is a family-owned Allstate insurance agency with 4 licensed insurance pros, saving thousands of Nebraska Husker fans money. They sell homeowner, auto, life, and flood insurance across Nebraska, and they also insure all the big boy toys. Motorcycles, boats, RVs, off-road vehicles, that U-Haul that Chris will be driving down to Kansas. If you have had your roof replaced in the last 5 years, give Daryl Schwalbach, Kyle Schwalbach, Nancy Mostick, or Kyle Murdoch a call at 402-590-5200. They can help you save a bundle. Free, no-obligation insurance reviews and quotes. They're going to make sure all of their fellow Nebraska fans are properly protected. You can contact them at 402-590-5200 or www.nebraskaallstate.com, www.nebraskaallstate.com. Thank you to Team Schwalbach. Okay, so – we are at the Well, we're inching closer to figuring out if there's going to be fall sports or not. Today, the NCAA Board of Governors is not scheduled to meet, but apparently they're going to, according to the media, which is an effective way of scheduling your meetings. they may decide that Division II and Division III sports and Division I fall sports championships are postponed or canceled. And if they're postponed or canceled, then the framework is that that's going to put pressure on college football to postpone or cancel its postseason. The NCAA does not govern the postseason of college football, and yet the decision has been framed that way. There's some people out there who really don't want college football to be played, and they're being granted anonymity as they say that.
Boy,
anyway,
ever.
Yeah. So it's an interesting story. As it stands right now, the fall sports championships that would be most affected, obviously soccer, volleyball, cross country, a few others, and what would be the impact to Omaha in this case is if the 2020 volleyball Final Four, which is scheduled to be in the CHI, that's what it's called now, right? It's the CHI Health Center. It's scheduled to be there in mid-December, right around the signing period for football. And if it's postponed, then Omaha will lose its third NCAA event in a calendar year. So it'd be kind of a big deal if that happened today. I'm not sure it will, but it could be a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Final Four, Nebraska volleyball's had been there every year that it's in Omaha. It's a huge setup, and yeah, for them not to have that, to have it pushed back, what would that look like? To have it scrapped altogether, you know, then you got to start figuring out would they get it back at some point. Not to mention the fact that, you know, Nebraska volleyball, this is one of its best teams on paper that it's had under John Cook. So
it could be a great team. There's no question they have a lot of potential. Yeah, that's a good point. And Creighton could be real good too. Yeah, this could be one of Creighton's better chances to get to the show. And how cool would it be if those two schools were able to, you know, be at the event at the same time?
Mm-hmm. Well, even if neither of them made it too, there's also this element of, you know, Nebraska fans, Nebraska volleyball fans in particular, respect and love their sport to an extent where whoever is at the Final Four, they're going to show up.
That's right.
So that's money right into Omaha's pocket anyway. So yeah, I'd be curious when, if it gets pushed, what happens from there? Because yeah, that'd be another loss for the city, which it, you know, would not be great because there's already been so much loss.
The College World Series loss was about $70 million economic impact. You don't get that one back. That was canceled. The NCAA tournament was less than that, much less, five to 10 million probably economic impact, just because there are fewer people and it doesn't last as long, et cetera, et cetera. But those are huge economic impacts to the city. Volleyball Final Four would probably be similar to the NCAA tournament, 5 to 10 million. But that one could get rescheduled to a different date. Trying to schedule that and navigating around Creighton basketball and a concert schedule, which tends to be somewhat robust in the spring at that arena, would be interesting. But you never know. Maybe you get it done. I think it's possible that the NCAA Board of Governors does not make a decision on Division I today, kicks that can down the road to August 4th. The reason why is because two of the major sports in the fall, soccer and volleyball, they can't even really contact and work with their athletes until August 4th. So you're not really cutting into their training time. If you make that decision now, there's not a crap or get off the pot date for volleyball or soccer prior to early August. And so you could probably move this decision until then, when they're ready to start training and they're ready to start setting their schedule, which they probably will know by late next week or have some sense of, and you can pull the plug then. It wouldn't make any difference. Division II and Division III, I could see them making a decision on that and moving forward. The NCAA does that out of whatever you want to call it, beneficence. I don't know if that's even a word, but Division II and Division III sports don't make any money, and I don't think the NCAA makes a lot of money off of staging those championships, if that makes sense. So it's a cost-saving measure for the NCAA to cancel those championships, and beyond that, it's a cost-saving measure for the schools to not have to worry about a playoff in a time when their schedules are going to be, you know, pretty screwed up anyway. So We'll see if the Division I decision comes down today. If it does, it does put some oblique pressure on the college football playoff, but not, you know, the college football thing is more of a political football than just the playoff for its or its conclusion. I think the thing, the primary concern is, can you play the regular season games and can you get 10 games in if possible? And if so, do you need a postseason? Obviously, the college football playoff postseason is a lot of money, but you don't need it, you know, to fulfill the conference contracts, the TV contracts. And if the kids and the coaches want to play, then, you know, it kind of makes sense.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we've just been in limbo here for a few weeks. I think Bill Moose told it to Chattel recently. They've about kicked that can as far down the road as they can.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting to that point with fall camp, August 7th, I believe.
Right.
And that's when you really got to start making some more football-based decisions. But, you know, I don't know. I think the other thing that strikes me, I guess, specific to Nebraska and Big Ten teams is having gone all, you know, conference only, there's not a ton of pressure for some of those other sports to make decisions right away, right? Because, you know, Nebraska volleyball's non-conference slate's wiped out. That usually was first 3 weeks. Soccer, same kind of deal. So, you know, some of those conferences that maybe haven't made that decision or scrambling a little bit, trying to fill some things in. But I think if you're a Nebraska fan, just trying to see how this affects your team, there's still some time, a lot of flexibility still to figure this out.
That's a good point, Evan.
The other thing I was going to say too, I think that in general, college football has a chance until the last minute. Like particularly in this state, like they are going to go up until they're going to try and play football until they are told that they absolutely cannot. So even if like fall championships are canceled today, I think in general, the sport of college football is going to continue to try and keep going. And though it may not look great, I think that what we've learned over the last couple of weeks is that they don't really care if it doesn't look great. They want to play football. And as long as they feel like they themselves can be safe, then they're going to continue to rage on. So, but at the same time, there is a certain element of, you know, you can only be in limbo for so long and the clock is still kind of ticking. And so I think it's tough if you have a decision in August. Let's say that they cancel everything in August. Well, all these players are then looking around saying, well, we just worked out for 2 months and are in great shape and are ready to hit the field and all this stuff. So now what? And they're kind of led astray. And so that'd be too hard. So it's kind of like, you want to let them know, but you also want to keep the ball rolling. And it's kind of it's a tricky dance. Like I don't envy anybody making decisions right now.
Yeah, it's tough. And in some places, you know, you're going to have political, you know, interference isn't the right word, political oversight. Right. So what you can do in Nebraska or Iowa or Minnesota may not be what you can do in California, Washington, Arizona. Those are different environments, or at least appear to be for the time being. But for example, in New Mexico, you know, the governor of New Mexico requested that the two college football teams, New Mexico and New Mexico State, don't play college football. And, how them playing college football affects the larger community, I don't know, other than the optics piece. And I people talk about optics probably too much, but maybe that's a legitimate thought process. But we'll see what happens today. No decisions are going to be made on college football today. You could see decisions made on other sports that would lose their fall sports championships. It doesn't necessarily mean that their regular seasons would be canceled because the NCAA has approved a split season. Moving on to recruiting, there's been a couple of decisions that have, since we spoke last, Nebraska received a commit from Marcus Buford, right? That was on Saturday.
Yep.
And a couple of guys that Nebraska was looking at, one of whom I think they had moved on from, which is Marcus Embo, and one of whom they hadn't, which is Christian Burkhalter, picked Arizona State and Oregon, respectively. Evan, you wrote about all three of those, and then we'll talk about Nadav Joseph in a minute. What's your thought on the three of those situations? They're all kind of different, and I and I feel like I have a pretty good handle on all three of them, but what's your thoughts on that trio of calls?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Buford last Saturday, first of all, that was a nice addition for Nebraska to get, you know, he's going the postgraduate route. So he played his last 2 years in Texas, did a really good job, played all over the field, was the lockdown, you know, the guy who locked down the opponent's best playmaker. They won a pair of state championships with him, and now he's going to Connecticut, St. Thomas More, same place that Alante Brown went last year. And, you know, his was a situation where, you know, a lot of things broke Nebraska's way. That connection with Alante Brown was big. The coaching staff, to hear Buford talk about it was a real team effort. He's like, I can't even name one guy who was my primary recruiter. He's like, one guy might text me, then another guy might text me or call me. And he said, you know, at some schools, he got the sense that the coaching staff was almost competing with itself, and someone would call and be like hoping that he'd be the coach to get the commitment. And he's like, I didn't care for that. He liked the team approach that Nebraska had out there. And ultimately they get a really solid playmaker who can, you know, play all over corner safety, has a real nose for the ball. So that's a nice addition for that class. And then you alluded to it with Marcus Simbeau, the offensive lineman
Let's talk about Malik Williams too. He committed to Nebraska this week.
Yeah.
Let's throw him in there too. I forgot about him briefly. I had a brain lapse, but let's talk Malik Williams and then we'll get to the two guys that didn't commit to Nebraska. Malik Williams.
Yeah. Malik Williams. I mean, that's another example, I think, of different connections kind of paying off for Nebraska. I mean, it helped that Gabe Irvin committed to them last month. And so he said that didn't have a huge factor, but that was, you know, something that was part of the thought process. And then he was good friends with Miles Farmer, who was part of the 2019 class for Nebraska out of the Atlanta area. So they knew each other. They were really tight. And so another example of players, and I think we're starting to see this more, where players at Nebraska are actively promoting the school, you know. And I think sometimes we can take that for granted, but there are situations out there where players won't necessarily, you know, stump for other players to come there. And that hasn't been the case with Nebraska. They've had a lot of good peer recruiting connections. So Williams comes on board, another defensive back. That's kind of been the theme of these additions. I think it's three straight defensive backs, along with Ladarius Webb Jr. out of Alabama or Mississippi now, where he'll play his senior year. But, you know, Williams was the school record holder in the long jump. I think it was a 23-2, probably would have contended for the state.
Yeah, that's a good jump.
Oh, yeah. Would have contended for that this year. So he's got some athletic ability. Another one of those, you know, football grinder types. And as we know, with Nebraska losing Henry Gray and Jaden Francois, they need some DBs. And you mentioned the Dab Joseph. If he commits tonight, that'd be a run of four defensive backs in the last, 10 days that Nebraska will have added for the next couple of seasons. So they're doing some work.
Malik Williams, back to him for a second. He didn't start last year, and his film is pretty limited. Why is that?
Yeah, he started – he was behind a pair of corners who are now with Power 5 teams, Georgia Tech and Arizona State. I think T. Lee was a player Nebraska was after. People might remember him from the previous recruiting cycle. He's at Arizona State. So the coaches – I mean, it's a powerhouse program at Buford. And but I do think that the thing that resonated with me was talking to their – position coach, and you know, he wasn't afraid to kind of roll out his accolades and say, you know, he's won 11 state titles, coached numerous players who've gone on to play D1, and he said physically, you know, Malik Williams is right up there with any guy that he's had. So I agree, and I know people have observed that the film isn't great, but you know, the opportunity maybe wasn't there, not through any fault of his own, but because of how loaded that team was in the secondary. So that state of Georgia is having football this fall. So I think that's going to be a big deal for him to get back out there too and kind of show what he can do.
He's a thicker guy. I don't know what he's – I don't know what his weight is listed. I mean, I don't know what his actual weight is. His listed weight, I think, is 187 when he put it out on an edit. That sounds about right. He seems maybe even a little thicker than that, maybe 190, 195. His physicality is body type probably closer to a Cam Taylor Brooks, for example, if Nadav Joseph come in 6'3", and he's, you know, 175 pounds or something like that. So he's a little bit different in that way.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And so, you know, and again, they could add Nadav Joseph to that 2020 class tonight. We can talk about him in a bit too. But the players they missed on, Marcus Simbeau, the offensive lineman from the Milwaukee area, you know, Nebraska has three commits in that 2021 class already. I agree. It's one of those situations, I think, where Nebraska decided they needed to kind of put their resources elsewhere. So he commits to Arizona State. And then the one that stung a little bit more, Christian Burkhalter out of Spanish Fort, Alabama, outside linebacker, who Nebraska had been on since, I think, February when they offered him. Felt like they were the lead contender for his services. And then Oregon comes in at the beginning of July, makes an offer, and he commits there. But I think it's notable with both Embo and Burkhalter that they both, from the very beginning, had said they wanted to get to Nebraska for a visit. They were unable to do so. And, you know, whatever went on behind the scenes, the fact remains, these are two players that would have come to Lincoln, that would have had the chance for the coaching staff to kind of roll out the red carpet and for Scott Frost to do what he does as a closer and all that good stuff. And to this point, it hasn't happened. And it's not to say that maybe it couldn't this fall if the recruiting opens up and you know, we see committed players come visit elsewhere all the time. But as it stands, I think it's two examples of where some of the pandemic-related shutdowns with recruiting have hurt.
Right. Well, I think you're going to see more Marcus Buford approaches where kids who really want to go to a place are just going to go. And they're going to meet with the players and hang out with them and take their own self-tours and whatever. But there's things that you really can't stop from happening just because the players set them up and they do it on their own volition. I think you could see more and more of those. Nadav Joseph, 6'2", 195. The number three junior college recruit in the country off of five games in 2 years. And eight tackles. That's it.
What do you make of that?
What do you make of it?
Well, it kind of reminds me of Latrell Neville a little bit. I mean, he was a highly rated receiver who Nebraska landed, didn't have a ton of production last year. So, you know, I think at some point the projectability has to come into play. I mean, I haven't personally spoken with any of his junior college coaches, but it sounds like he's an athletic freak, SEC-type talent. You know, I think his situation just continues to remind me that Nebraska has to be creative in how it finds guys. You know, Keem Green was the same sort of deal last year where he didn't arrive till early August. I think Joseph will be a bigger impact guy, a three for three type of guy, which is a big deal. but you know, that staff had the track record with Mike Hughes at UCF, yeah, who came in late. He was a first round NFL draft pick. I think Will Jackson was another example of that, right? Kind of went the other way where he left and kind of fizzled out after a few weeks, but you know, it's been an interesting recruiting process with Joseph because he's been so quiet about it. There just hasn't been a lot of information out there. People haven't been super forthcoming with it. So, it's tough because it's tough to gauge because we haven't really kind of seen that full glimpse of behind the scenes, what's been going on. But at the same time, man, yeah, this he could put a big exclamation point on that 2020 class for sure.
You know, Joseph's been on recruiting radars for about 4 years, and you know, he knocked it out of the park in camps when he was going into his sophomore season in 2016. Committed to LSU at that time. LSU probably doesn't take a bunch of sophomore to be commitments, right? That happens sometimes, but it's not that common. I can't even remember, the fall of 2017 or 2018. He's committed to Alabama. Alabama doesn't take commits lightly. And then he doesn't sign with either one of those two teams. He ends up signing with Georgia, but then he doesn't go to Georgia. He goes to junior college. What we're going to find out, and I think we're going to find it out pretty fast, is whether or not Nadav Joseph's recruiting ranking which again is not based on, and I'm saying recruiting ranking coming out of junior college, it's not based on production. It's based right. on the kind of player he was in high school. There's not a ton of film of him as high school senior year. And it's based on, I think, the fact that LSU, Alabama, and Georgia, among other schools, wanted him to play there. We're going to find out really quick if his recruiting ranking coming out of junior college is rooted in something that was true 3 or 4 years ago, or if he still has that skill set. Sometimes recruiting rankings interest me, and this is an example of where I don't really know how a guy can be the number one corner in his class when at the collegiate level he didn't play a lot, unless you know, when the evaluators went out, you know, in the preceding spring, they're like, this guy is unbelievable. And he's so good that nobody even throws at him. And that's possible. And hopefully that's what Nebraska's getting. I mean, they're getting a giant guy, probably 6'2", 190. You know, so Taman Lineham, I think, is going to end up 6'2 and a half, 6'3", but he's probably not going to be 190 right away. Braxton Clark is at that size, but I don't think he has Nadab Joseph's speed. I think Braxton Clark is probably a 4.45s, you know, 4.5s, 4.6 guy maybe. Apparently, Nadab Joseph was running a 4.5 40 when he was, you know, 15 years old. So you put that guy in a training system and you give him some training and some speed and some nutrition and weight room that he hasn't had. He hasn't had the advantages of any of those things yet at the level that Nebraska can provide it. And you might have a guy who's 6'2", 195 who can run a 4.4. And if you can do that, what's true of a 6'2", 195 corner? What would generally be true of that guy?
Sounds like a lockdown type of player.
It would be a physical player, right? So, like, if you have that length and you have that size and that physicality, and he is physical, then throwing the ball short against a guy like that is hard. See Lamar Jackson. How many short, you know, 7-yard throws did Lamar give up his last two seasons at Nebraska? Not that many. In 2017, he did, because Bob Diaco liked that off coverage and liked the guys, you know, 10 yards off and coming up and tackling at 5. But in his last 2 years, throwing short on Lamar Jackson was not easy because he was long and he could get his arms involved. A guy like that is easier to get deep because maybe they don't flip their hips as fast and maybe they're not as fast. You can get behind them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Jackson was pretty good deep. You know, he got beat at Colorado. That was costly. But he was pretty good deep. But if Nadab Joseph can run a 4.4, you know, if he can run in that area and he's big and long and physical, you got a good corner. You got a really good corner. You got a guy that I'm not sure they have right now. I think Cam Taylor-Britt can run that, but he's not 6'2", 195. He's about 6 foot and 200. So, you know, like that would be the ideal scenario, that you have a player who can do those things and then you put him out on an island and say, Nadab Joseph, go cover Rashad Bateman. And we don't expect you to knock him. We don't expect you to shut him down all night, but we do expect you to do something to him. And Lamar Jackson last year against Rashad Bateman did pretty well. He did not get whipped by Rashad Bateman in that game. Now, Minnesota ran to its heart's delight. They didn't have to throw the ball, but that's kind of what you're looking for. And I'm not sure that, you know, if it isn't Joseph, then it's going to be either Braxton Clark or Cam Taylor-Britt that takes that role over. And I don't know that either one of those guys are as good as Lamar Jackson was.
I mean, that's probably true, but man, that depth at corner, suddenly that's getting up there. I mean, if Clark and Taylor-Britt are your backup corners and they still have Newsome back there, we don't know how they're going to use Ronald Delancey at some point. I mean, that's a heck of a start. And you've got those guys being mentored by some seniors in Boodle and Markel Dismuke and Deontay Williams. I mean, we've talked about it before, but man, that DB's room, even with the attrition of Gray and Francois as a pair of 4-star defenders, is still looking pretty good.
It is. You know, I think Taylor-Britt could play outside a corner. He could play in nickel. What would be great is if Nadab Joseph commits and he's really good right away. It gives you the freedom to take a guy like Cam Taylor-Britt and put him at nickel.
right,
where he can play slot corner, or, and I'm talking against Purdue here. Let's talk about Purdue just for a second. Purdue's going to roll out three receivers, Rondale Moore, Bell, and I can't remember the other guy's name, plus a tight end who's a, you know, was a top 100 guy last year, freshman. And you tell me how Nebraska covers that. Now, Nebraska can't cover that with JoJo Doman on Rondale Moore. Good night. No. That's not probably going to happen. Now, I'm not trying to knock JoJo. I love him. But I doubt that you're going to have that matchup, Rondale Moore in the slot against an outside linebacker. So you got to pull a corner into the action, which Nebraska didn't have to worry about last year because Moore was hurt. And they still got, you know, still got beat up. But you put Cam Taylor-Britt in there, and then you got Joseph on the outside against one of the bigger guys, Bill, and I can't remember the other guy's name. And all of a sudden, maybe you're covering Purdue. Because right now, if I look at Purdue's offense and I look at the fact that they're returning two quarterbacks, I'm looking at yards a game based on what they got with the shit. But they could run, they could throw it. Nebraska's got to be able to you know, to compensate in that way.
You got eaten a little bit by internet monster, but I think the
– my internet was unstable.
No, it was good. Anderson?
No.
Anthrop?
No.
Going down right?
Yep.
Yeah, that's 16. That's 16 yards catch, so that makes sense.
And then Bell was right is closer to a Rashad Bateman. Bell is closer to a Tyler Johnson. Mm. The right is like 6'3", 210 or something. They're good, man. I mean, Purdue's receivers are they're legit.
Not to make this
if Nebraska had they had Purdue's receivers, they might be favored. In the I mean, and Nebraska might have Purdue's receivers. I don't know. Wendell Robinson, in my opinion, is probably is about as good as Rondale Moore when he's healthy. And if Omar Manning is as good as everybody thinks he is, they might be closer to Purdue's receivers than we think.
Not to make this a radio topic, but if you were ranking Nebraska's positions, where would you put the secondary?
High.
I mean, are they, I mean, top three, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You talking about the Big Ten, or are you talking about on Nebraska's team?
On the team, I mean.
Two.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. I go
one. Would you put one?
O-line. I like Nebraska's O-line.
Yeah.
Tight end is sort of a betwixt and between position. I don't know what you do with it exactly. But three, if you put tight end, it's its own position. Because I think the tight end spot's going to be real nice, but that's just one guy on the field most of the time.
Right.
So I'd say two. If you put the tight ends with the wide receivers, and I'd say the DBs are two, O-line's one. They're going to be good. Offensive line's going to be good. Greg Austin likes what he has, and people should not take his confidence lightly.
Well, they also return a ridiculous amount of starts in a row, even. I mean, you look at how many starts Brendan Hymus and Matt Farniak and Bo Wilson even have all in a row. It's pretty ridiculous. We were talking about the secondary. I just wanted to throw out there. I just feel like they are probably the position group that I feel most comfortable about. Like, I think offensive line, it's always kind of, even if you feel good about it, there's still kind of some hesitation, right? And I think that part of that is just based on the way that the state views that, you know, because they've been burned before. But I think it says something that you lose Lamar Jackson, who's playing in the NFL, who's on an NFL team, and you still feel good about what you have at your corners and your nickels and your safeties. Like, I think that says a lot.
Right.
I mean, I think it's probably splitting hairs between the O-line and the DBs. I like the leadership on that O-line with Dismuke and Williams and Boodle. Those guys have been good. And so, like, I think you see established production from last year, leadership this year, and you can kind of see where it's going in the next couple of years. Mm-hmm. You know, the O-line, I think, has tremendous upside, more depth than they've had in many seasons. But, yeah, clearly those are your two top positions on the team in terms of development, depth, talent, I would say all of that.
Which is notable too, because think about those two positions like 3 years ago.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yep. Evan, you wrote up thoughts on Eric Chenander earlier this week. Did you have any leftover thoughts from that? He talked about the whole defense. He was pretty frank about the linebackers. We'll get to that in a minute. But his optimism about the defensive line, I thought, was interesting.
Yeah, I agree. That was the part that stood out to me, too. I mean, he mentioned about leaders and, you know, it seemed like inside linebacker was pretty well set with Honus and Miller, and he liked his number twos as well. But, yeah, I think cautiously optimistic was what he said for the defensive line. I don't know. It's going to be interesting because you lose all three starters, the Davis twins, Darian Daniels, and they've got depth back there. They definitely have depth. But, you know, we just haven't seen it. And against Big Ten O-lines in the trenches, Nebraska's had trouble stopping the run, getting to the quarterback, you know, kind of the main things you need to do. Ben Stille's the senior. I think it's pretty clear that he'll start and maybe even be captain material this year. But I think a lot of the other guys, to me, there's still a kind of a prove it element to it. You know, Damian Daniels is a junior now. Does he have the stamina to stay on the field, you know, for quite a while for a drive? Deontre Thomas, kind of the same thing. He was a guy recruited in a four-man front, and he's been kind of playing out of position a lot of his career. So how does he kind of settle in? What do we see from Keem Green when he wasn't ready last year? And then we don't know, I know a ton about maybe the JUCO guys. Jordan Riley had some positive reviews as a nose tackle. He could be a big X factor. Feldarius Payne is kind of that change of pace guy that they like as a pass rusher, but he's not necessarily an in the trenches kind of guy. And I think we've seen the workout videos of Ty Robinson and what he can do. So like there's potential there. I think you can make a case for how they could have 6 to 8 guys that they feel good about, but man, like we just haven't seen it in so long that it feels like it's taking a leap to say that that's going to be a strength of the team this year.
Good thought. You could close your eyes and say Ben Stille, Damian Daniels, and Deontre Thomas are your starting defensive line. They have the most experience and they have the most production. You know, you put that line out there against Iowa. How do they do? I just don't know. That's a big question. You know, Stille and Thomas are not really any bigger than Carlos and Khalil Davis. Stille's taller, but he's not 322 pounds or anything. He's not 6'6", 320. And Deontre Thomas is probably smaller than both of those guys. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that you're gaining the whole height and length thing if you're putting that. And then Damian Daniels is the same size as his brother. So that's pretty much the same defensive line as last year, only it isn't as good.
So. Deontre Thomas is a really interesting case study because, I mean
– Uyoti likes him a lot.
Well, he if, correct me if I'm wrong, he played as a true freshman in 2017. Oh, yeah. He was one of the only true freshmen who played on the line that year.
Nose tackle. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, he was playing nose tackle.
Right. Aaron Donald's is the same size as Deontre Thomas. So it's physically possible to play that position and play it well at that size. It's more a question of what you want the guy to do. If what they want Deontre Thomas to do is to set the edge and to hold himself up against 600 pounds of badger or Hawkeye beef, well, then I don't know if that's what you want him doing. If you want him penetrating like Malik Collins used to do and getting into the backfield and bouncing plays outside, we can do that. So I think it's more a question of what they want their defensive lineman to do. Mm-hmm.
I agree. The other thing I was going to say, too, is just clearly coaches have always liked what he has to bring. Yeah. But he's not necessarily always been – he's always been kind of like a second quarter, third down. He's going to run out and he's going to play, a snap or two. and this is kind of in some ways like his moment. Like, he's one of the more experienced guys, you know, like you said, close your eyes, you picture him on the starting line. I'm really curious what, this is going to be so cliche, but like what a spring could have done for him, or what, summer workouts plus a spring and all these things could have helped. He's a really interesting, like, kind of side note storyline for next year, just because this is kind of his moment.
Right.
And clearly there's been flashes, and I'm curious if he'll live up to what the coaches see.
Mm-hmm. Then you have an alternate universe. Your starting line is Jordan Riley, Ty Robinson, and King Green.
Quite a bit bigger. Quite a bit bigger.
It's different. It's a different line.
Yeah. I think Chenander mentioned this too, but it's been a while since Nebraska's had kind of a diverse group at that position to kind of do different things. So kind of like you said, if your goal in a 3-4 is to, as a lineman in a 3-4, is to take up space, set the edge, and allow your linebackers to make plays, then the lineup you just mentioned, I think, is the way to go. I mean, those are your big body dudes that can go toe-to-toe with some bigger, offensive linemen on the other side. If you're in a third and, medium, or third and long, and you're looking to try to get some pressure in, then I think you go back to some of the guys we just talked about. DeAndre Thomas, maybe. Fildarius Payne, certainly.
Still, he is a better pass rusher than he's been given credit for in his career.
Yeah.
Still is going to start either way, but I would say Ben Stille has been a pretty good pass rusher. He started as an outside linebacker, remember, and he's progressed to defensive end, but he's pretty good. Against the run, Stille probably isn't as good as, say, some other players that Nebraska's had in the past, but as a pass rusher, I'd say he's underrated.
Yeah.
And will help them in that way. But, I don't know. That, to me, is a really interesting conversation because, again, you can sort of click your heels and say, well, here's your starting front seven. In fact, you could say, here's your starting defense. I could rattle off all those names. They're all guys that played last year. Problem is, last year's defense wasn't that good. It was okay. It wasn't great. It was good at times. It was good for stretches, but it wasn't consistently good. And if these guys weren't good enough in general to start last year, I don't know why an offseason without a spring and with a truncated summer would suddenly mean that there was a better group. But maybe I'm wrong. And maybe playing Purdue early, it depends on who you play. If your schedule early is Purdue, Illinois, Northwestern, which it could be. It could be out of the gate. Let's play mm-hmm. Purdue, Illinois, Northwestern. Then maybe your defense can roll a little bit and you can say, all right, we can do some things against those teams. But, then you have, let's say you're playing Purdue, Iowa, Wisconsin, and you're getting slapped around early. Like you have to be big boy pants right away. You can't. Wisconsin is going to give you a break. Illinois might, that kind of thing. So you just never, you just don't know what exactly until the schedule is finalized. Man. And then that crossover game is Maryland. And they're like, all right, let's just do what we got to do. Maybe the crossover game is Michigan State. Michigan State's physical. Now, they're not that good, but they're physical. And you can't just – you have to man up against them. So there's a lot of different ways, I guess, to attack it.
This whole, if there's a football season, so much of it's just going to be trial and error. And I hope that coaches will say that and be honest about it, because it totally is going to be trial and error. Well, this is what we think is probably going to work, but we don't really know because we don't really see it a lot. So let's just roll it out there. And if it doesn't work, then they can be like, listen, we were pretty sure this was going to work because we didn't really know. But it's super interesting because everybody's just going to be throwing stuff on the wall and seeing what sticks.
I think the other thing about the D-line, especially, that's interesting, with the D-line, it sets the tone for everything. So we just talked about the secondary, but it doesn't really matter how good they are if Wisconsin can, go off-tackle, over and over and over and just the ball.
Which they did last year.
Right. So it doesn't matter how
good your team is. 40-minute Nebraska-Wisconsin game on YouTube, Evan. I've watched it like three times now. It's worth watching because you don't have any of the commercials or any of the crap. Just watch how many times Wisconsin just runs the ball for 5 yards.
Mm-hmm.
They don't break any 80-yard runs, but they break like a bunch of 5- and 6-yard runs over and over and over. That's because they can't get – Nebraska couldn't stop them.
What was Jonathan Taylor's longest run that game?
Wisconsin didn't even get into it.
Right.
Sam, do you remember what – was it 20? It was like 20, wasn't it?
Scheme, you can't always – like that. You can't always guarantee a scheme that says, we're going to stop this guy from having any 40-yard runs. You can't always do that. But you can set up your defense in a way that, you know, allows you to – can you hear me? Am I there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. You can set up your defense in a way that, you know, prevents bigger plays from happening and or reasonably prevents against it. And I think in that game, Nebraska did a really nice kickoff return, but they weren't able to actually stop Wisconsin very often. And so Wisconsin held the ball for, I don't know, some 40 minutes or something crazy, 37 minutes, 38 minutes, because all Wisconsin had to do was run for 5 yards a lot. And they were able to do it. And so Nebraska's got it. You know, you want a defense that can they can put a team in 2nd and 12 and 2nd and 13. You have to get it to that point where you can force them to make a mistake. And Wisconsin wasn't forced into a lot of errors in that game. They were able to just kind of stay on schedule and do what they do.
His Jonathan Taylor's longest run was 19 yards, but he averaged 8 yards a carry.
Didn't that tell you something? How many carries did he have?
25.
Yeah.
25, 204, 2 touchdowns.
Yeah. That gives you a sense of how much Wisconsin's offensive line won that battle in the game. Yeah. Yep.
And to your point, it was against pretty much players who are still there right now. Right? I think Darian Daniels and maybe one of the Davis twins missed that game or large chunks of that game. So it was really kind of a preview of what it could have looked like this season if they don't make any changes.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about the linebackers, but I actually think I'm ready for Chris to charge chatting about his memories of the World Herald and, well, of Nebraska athletics. So, you, Chris, you worked for the Daily Nebraskan for years, obviously. You worked for a website, which we will not mention. And then you worked for the World Herald for the last three. Right? Last three.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be almost three exactly, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, talk about where you're going to the extent you want to talk about what you're going to be doing next, and then just some reflections on covering three tumultuous years of Nebraska athletics. It has not been boring, but it hasn't been that successful.
No, it has not been boring. It's not been boring at all. No. We are headed back to Kansas. My wife graduated from pharmacy school this spring, and she got a job down in Manhattan where she went to school at the first pharmacy that she worked at. And it's a wonderful job with wonderful people. And so she's going to go do that. And then I am going back to school. I'm going to be the third person in my family. Actually, interestingly enough, I'll be the third person in my family to go to KU. I will also be the third person in my family to live in Manhattan. Been a weird, heady tradition. And none of us have lived there at the same time. Yeah. But I'm going back to school, going to KU, going to get my master's in journalism. I'll be a graduate teaching assistant in the journalism school. It's something I've always wanted to do. It's something that, you know, when I was a sophomore in high school, that's where I found Rick Riley's book, Hate Mail for Cheerleaders, and I realized I wanted to be a reporter. And then when I got into college, I started going back to this high school journalism conference every summer that I went to when I was in high school, and I went back and started helping teach with a professor at Nebraska. And my job that week when I was in Dallas at the conference was to be a writing coach, essentially. So the class we taught was specialized writing, and it's with high school students from Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas and Kansas and Missouri. One of the first assignments is, you know, write the defining moment of your life, write 300 words, exactly 300 words, not one word less, not one word more. And essentially they swap that with somebody from a different school. They write feature stories about the other person with that defining moment. And then they end up writing a personal column. And so my job a lot of the time was to be the writing coach for their personal column and their feature stories. And when you sit down with people and they tell you why they are the way they are, and this is the first time that they're sharing these things, or the first time they've experienced writing or effective storytelling, and you kind of see the light bulb go on, and they are able to share that story with people. That's, I mean, like you've said, I've covered sports for 3 years at the World Herald, and I've written a lot of things, but there's nothing that's even come close to that feeling.
Yeah.
Of sitting with a kid and them telling why they want to be a writer and these things that happen in their life and what they want to do. And every time I would come back from that conference, I would be like, I would literally tell Molly, I was like, I'm not allowed to not be a teacher one day. Like, I don't know when it's going to be. Like, that's something that I can't not do. And so the plan had always been to be writing for, you know, 10 years and then go back to school and figure it out or whatever. And the timeline kind of sped up, but it's one of those things where it's going to suck to leave. Like, I've loved this paper. I got so lucky with the editors and you two and everyone else at the paper that it's hard to find a good job. I know what it's like to not have a good job. And so walking away from that is always really hard.
Yeah.
But I just often find, like, in my free time, I'm often thinking of, you know, I'll read a story and I'll think, like, this is great. Like, I need to keep this so that in 10 years we can read it in class. Or yeah. I'll see some media thing happening, you know, spats at the New York Times or hedge funds taking over newspapers or things like that. And I keep thinking, like, I wonder, like, how we could discuss this in a way of, like, how is this affecting journalism now? Like, what's the difference between now and then? And it's just what occupies my brain space. And so to go back to school and try and learn more about that and to be able to, you know, in a small slice, be a TA for classes to try that, will be exciting and fun. But, you know, I've lived in Nebraska since 2012, went to school there for 4 years, and covered it for a year at the website, covered it for 3 years here. Like, I'm going to miss a lot about the state. I'm going to miss, you know, I think I told Evan once this, like, I'm going to miss the walk from practice to the press box.
Walk you back.
The walk back, not the walk to, the walk back, but just like figuring out what we need to do. Right. I'll really miss, it seemed like, you know, it was my job to write the online game story. And it seemed like every time you guys left, Nebraska was up 21 and then all of a sudden they're up 3. And like Arkansas State has the ball and they're driving and it's like, all right, well, we're deleting everything. And so now let's figure, like, you know what I mean? Like, holy cow, they're at the 15. And like, so I'll really miss that rush. And then like immediately sending something and packing up my stuff and trying to get to the elevator as quickly as possible and running across the field to try and get to the press conference and making sure I didn't, you know, I made it on time. And,
right.
Just those small things, I'll really miss. But I'll miss it a lot. I really will. But
I think you miss the juice. You're gonna miss the daily whatever stuff happening, and then not being able to write about it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's the thing that's always the reason why I got so lucky at this specific paper is you two and Dirk and Thad have encouraged and wanted. I mean, Evan can attest to this too. I mean, when you have a story idea of wanting to write about somebody and you want 5,000 words, like the paper is like, yeah, do it, go for it, take the time. Like, this is what we want you to do.
Right.
And to be able to say, hey, I'm driving to Ames to go figure out who Fred Hoiberg was, like, give me a week, or to drive to, you know, the middle of Nebraska to sit down with Teddy Allen and talk to him about his life and talk to his coach about his life and watch how he interacts with people, and or to drive 10 hours down to Dallas and try and figure out where Maurice Washington is and try and, you know, spend a day with Cam Jones. That stuff, you know, I don't think people realize that doesn't happen at every newspaper. And that's what's going to bug me, is like sitting on the, you know, watching a football game or a basketball game and being like, man, I wish I could take a week and do 1500 words on Trey McGowan. Or I wish that I could go hang out with Lat Man for a little bit. Or, you know, go have lunch with Dedrick Mills. But I think that instead we would like just be lifting weights. Like, I think that's the interview with Dedrick Mills, with like angry music in the background. So yeah, that's going to be really hard, and that's going to be annoying, but it's like one of those things where you can't always necessarily have both. And I also think I've tried to, when I was in college and when I was in high school, I wrote a lot for me. And I think if I can even just find ways to do that, then that would really help. But I don't know. We'll see.
And you got to have a master's thesis, right?
I do. Yeah. I've thought a lot about what I wanted to be. I have no idea.
Well, that'll be a journalism project and probably a big one.
Yeah.
The other thing for you, Chris, is I think a lot of readers would attest to this too. And that's like, I think when you think of your 3 years here, there are certain stories that I think will stand out to people, whether that was, you know, some that I can think of, like the Mo Berry tattoo story was really creative and interesting. Lamar Jackson's story, Maurice Washington. My personal favorite was Teddy Allen and kind of breaking that whole thing down. And that was really well told for me. And so I think that's one of the ultimate compliments too, is that people will think of certain things that you did, how it made them feel, how it showed sports in illustrated sports in a way that they hadn't maybe thought of before. And so, yeah, I know people are going to miss that. I'm going to miss that.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you. That's why I got into journalism in the first place. Like, if I could write one story a month, that'd be great. The problem is that job doesn't exist anymore. I hope that people remember that and not just like, oh yeah, the guy that like really likes Revenge of the Sith, like that guy. Because I think that that's probably more relevant. That
remember things for all kinds of reasons, but yeah. I get you.
I don't know. I think what I'll remember most, I remember Teddy Allen. That was probably the hardest story I've ever had to write. That was emotionally draining because there were a lot of things that intersected with my life, and he has a really heavy story, and it was trying to figure out how to present somebody in a way in which, you know, there's a perception about him that some of those things are true, but not everything is true. And so how do you get to truth, and, you know, who's this kid really, and why you
take Teddy him is a good quote.
Teddy's a fantastic quote.
Yeah.
You know, actually, the problem with that,
because Teddy can explain his story really well, and you have to determine the difference between a guy that can talk about his story really well and whether or not every piece of what he says is, you know, there's two sides to what a person says.
Well, not only that, but every person I talked to in that story was a good quote. And it was like, okay, well, I've got 20,000 words of great stuff. So how do I make it five so that Dirk can cut it to three?
Hey, Chris, give me your Mount Rushmore of best quotes during your 3 year run at Nebraska, covering Nebraska.
Yeah.
Boy, that's good. I mean, from that story, the Western Nebraska coach Corey, he told me, he was like, if you want to know Teddy Allen, you can't look at what you see on the surface. You have to look at his heart. And that was a really nice sentiment, I thought. The thing that comes to my mind, like the first thing that actually came to my mind was Tim Miles, which, you know, take your pick.
I guess that's what I mean, like player or coach, who in general was the best quote?
Well, I just mean this was at practice. And this was when things were getting hot and heavy at the end of the year. Things were going bad. We had reported that Nebraska was in, that had reached out to Fred Hoiberg. And that next day, we go to basketball practice to talk to Tim. And he's sitting there, and you know, we do the interview. And interview's done, cameras turn off. And Tim looks at his Apple Watch and he goes, "All right, well, it's 12:30. Anybody else get offered my job yet?" And then gets up and he walks away.
It's good.
That season was so, I mean, invigorating, because the other thing I think of too is when they finally lost in that Big Ten title or the Big Ten tournament. He said, we had asked him, "Is it odd to be standing here and not know what your job status is, of whether or not you're going to get fired or not?" And it was phrased more delicately than that. And he said, "I've accepted that I've ran my race." And it was just, I was like, okay, well, there's some wisdom there. And that's also kind of sad. I'll never forget talking to Mike Riley about Kendrick Lamar. That was an interesting conversation. Yeah. It's one of my favorite all-time photos is of Mike Riley in a soccer jersey and like standing next to Kendrick Lamar. He like walked in. That was one of my first assignments here at the paper, because Sam, you and I, when I was at the other place, I didn't ever really feel like I had the authority to like take Mike to the side and like talk to him. But once I got over at the World Herald, it was, you know, Nebraska was going to a Kendrick Lamar concert, and Sam was like, I want you to go talk to Mike about meeting Kendrick Lamar and write a story about it. And I was like, oh, okay. So I remember it was, I think, a Thursday practice. So it was at Memorial Stadium. And I walked with him into the hallway. I was like, "Hey, Mike, do you have a second?" He's like, "Yeah, can. Well, let's walk." I was like, "Oh, cool. I'm going to walk." And I asked him about Kendrick Lamar, and he was like, "You know, I walked into the Pingle Bank Arena, and they took me onto this back room, and there was Kendrick, and he was working out on an exercise bike, and there was all these guys in there." And I was like, "This is just the funniest picture." And they had got the photo together, and Kendrick has like, pretty sure he has like a towel around his neck, and they're like hanging out, and it was just great. So yeah, that's what I would think there. I'll never forget. I mean, not to continue rambling, but I'll never forget talking to Noor, the first athlete at Nebraska to wear a hijab. Talking to her was interesting because I didn't know a lot about her or her world, and that was hard to walk into, because, you know, I'm a white guy from Kansas. Like, I don't know a lot about her world, being Muslim or being a female golfer. Like, what's that like? And so I had to do a lot of prep work before even going into the interview, because I didn't want to come off as ignorant, and I didn't want to come off as like, here's one thing about you and that defines you. But her talking about, you know, the realization of representation, why it matters, is, you know, she was trying to figure out how she could fight back against, you know, this white supremacist on campus, and basically said, you know, me just existing, me being here and continuing to be here, like that is what matters. And that's why, like, just me being here is a stance. And so those are the things that I'll remember, is kind of the accidentally profound moments when people kind of realize something. That's what I remember. And Tim, just being Tim. So.
Yeah. Tim Miles' impact on, here's what I would say about Tim Miles. Tim Miles' impact on Nebraska athletics and basketball will go beyond just his experience as a coach. Mm-hmm. I think Fred Hoiberg is a good guy. And honestly, I think he can probably take the program places that Miles could not. But Tim Miles had a one of us kind of quality that fans really gravitated to and liked. Even when his teams weren't that good, he was comfortable.
And fans were comfortable with him in ways that it's hard to gauge when you're in the media because it's more of a bottom line win-lose kind of deal. But I think what struck me about it is stories that you wrote about Tim Miles subsequent to after his firing got a lot of reads. People, you know, there's a roofing company that wants to put Tim Miles in a commercial after he was let go.
Yeah.
That's something. That's mm-hmm. notable.
Oh, yeah.
There's something about Tim that I think has still going to sort of linger within the program, this sense of maybe he didn't win the way that he should have. But there's people that are like, but I kind of liked who he was and what he was about. And here's my question to you. Having seen that last year of Miles and the emotion that it was involved there and the, you know, all the things that happened. And now Hoiberg, who's a different cat. He's a different guy. And I like him, actually. But he's cerebral. There's a certain level of remove or reserve to Fred. He keeps a little bit back. Where do you think the program's going to go? Like, what do you think is going to happen? Because, you know, I think Hoiberg got mad at times last year, but he never really showed that, like, a ton. Like, he never just ripped his team a new one. It was almost kind of like, we're bad, and, oh, by the way, most of these guys won't be here next year anyway. Like, there's a certain quality to him that I actually appreciate, sort of a cerebral, emotional remove from the process. But I'm just curious where you think the program's going to go and how the whole thing with Miles ended and whether that still lingers and so on and so on.
Yeah, I think what you said about Tim and his effect, I think it's true. People care about Tim. I mean, I think the way that I view it, I think in general there's two types of basketball coaches. One who, after the game, they're disheveled. Their tie is either loose or not existent anymore. They're sweaty. They feel like they just ran a marathon because they're very emotionally invested. There were times when Tim literally got onto the floor to convince his team to get a loose ball. Like, I remember watching it multiple times. Right. Very, 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 very involved. And then there is the coach that is quiet and is thinking and thoughtful and has all of those emotions, but keeps them very locked in a vault, and they come out at specific moments. And when they do, it means a lot. So Fred has gotten upset with his team before. And when he does get upset, it is notable because it's one of the few times that actually happens, right? You know, he breaks a clipboard in Italy. That means something, right? Whereas with Tim, not that he broke a lot of clipboards, but he was yelling all the time, right? Like and so it's one of those things where if he's yelling, it's like, well, yeah. And so I think the difference, always. And so I think because Tim coached the way that he did, people, you know, Nebraska basketball fans want so much. Like there's such a need, not a need, but there's just a thirst. And Tim shared that because Tim's success was directly tied to fans' success, if that makes sense. You know, Tim came from Colorado State. He had a chip on his shoulder. He was always an underdog. He felt like, I think he and Nebraska basketball fans intertwined with that emotionally. The difference with Fred is he has been there and he has done that. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like, you know, in soccer, you can be on loan. In some ways, it feels like he is on loan. And not saying that he's going to leave anytime soon or that it's not more important or less important, but just the feeling is, we've got this guy who's done it before. He's going to come here. He's going to kind of teach us the ways, right? It's almost like, you know, hiring like a specialist to come in to your practice and teach you a specific thing. And so I think emotionally it feels different because again, and you can even go a little bit further, Tim recruited kids out of high school. You knew who they were. 4 years there, Isaiah Roby, you know, tried to kind of build a team. Fred is, again, kind of picking this and picking that and putting it together and it doesn't work. Ah, okay, we'll wipe this, you know, swipe it clean. Let's go this, let's do that. We'll kind of figure it out. And so I think that's why Tim resonates because it just felt more emotionally draining and he went up and down with the emotions of the fan base. With Fred, it's a lot more solidified. And so to answer your second question in terms of where the program is going, I mean, I think that Fred has a vision, and I think if you got him in an honest moment when talking about last season, he would admit they just were trying to get the guys they could in the time frame that they could. And maybe their mistake was maybe talking them up a little bit more than they were, but I think they were also trying to rationalize why they took who they took, mm-hmm. and to themselves and to the fan base of, you know, hey, trust us.
Sure.
And that clearly didn't go great. And I think by midway through the season, there was a sense of like, these guys are gone and these guys don't maybe care as much.
Right.
And it was a really immature team. And, you know, when you, not to, you know, knock the guy, but when you specifically recruit somebody to do one thing and then that person is unable to do that at that level, that's demoralizing and also hurts. So like Mate, right? I think Mate is a very good basketball player. I really do. He's scored more than 1,000 points in his career. But when he comes to Nebraska, gets off to kind of a rocky start, he's kind of a defensive liability, then there becomes this thing where it's like all these guys started kind of playing for each other. I think by the end of the season, that was kind of clear. They were basically trying to play in some ways to better their school, better the next school they're going to go to. And that's kind of the way it felt at times, because clearly it was just a mess. But in the meantime, while that's all going on, they are taking more time to recruit who they want to recruit for next season. So you get Teddy and you get Latt and you get Trey McGowan and you get Kobe Webster. And every day in practice, you're seeing the three guys that you recruited that are sitting out, that are working. And I'll tell you what, it wasn't, you know, it was notable every time we went to a media availability, the three guys that were still practicing were the three set out transfers almost every single time. And there were starters that were just gone, not getting up no more shots. You know, they were there, then they were gone. And so I think that they now have a roster of guys who, and Fred has, one thing Fred does is he likes to repeat himself, but when he does repeat himself, you know that it's true, that this is a group that likes to work. This is a group that wants to get better. They appreciate their craft. And they also, a lot of them have something to play for, and they've done it before. And a lot of them, they have been somewhere and that got taken away from them, and now they want to prove that they deserve to be there in the first place. Or they were at some school, felt slighted that they weren't actually playing, and have something to prove again. So I think that this next year's team is going to be motivated in a way that last year's team absolutely was not. Mm-hmm. They're going to be experienced in a way that last year's team was not. The complication comes with the chemistry, and that's the risk that Fred and Matt Abdelmassi and the program take, but they will take every time, which is we're going to throw these guys together and we're really going to hope that this, you know, that this looks good and works. And sometimes that works. It did at Iowa State. And so if you get, you know, if you throw a starting five out there with Delano Banton, Teddy Allen, you know, Latt Mann, Shamil Stevenson, Kobe Webster, you know, and they ball's moving, they're hitting threes. You've got Delano, who's a matchup nightmare, Latt stretching the floor, Kobe's, you know, working, Teddy Allen's making shots. You bring in some guys from the bench, it just works. Thor's a nice lubricant to everything. Like if it all, you know, there is a scenario in which this all really works. But I do think, I was telling somebody yesterday that this next season, let's pretend that it's going to be completely normal, which I don't think it's going to be, but let's say it is, could mimic the first season at Iowa State, where they win some games they shouldn't, they go on a losing streak and learn some, you know, things about themselves. It's not perfect, it's not always pretty, but you go 500, you know, you win a game or two in the Big Ten tournament, you feel like, okay, this program is starting to go places. Whereas last year it felt like, well, this is a nightmare. And so I think if that happens, then you can start to see Fred building. And I think that you're starting to see that a little bit with, you know, they've got Kobe Webster now, and then once he's gone, then you have Trey McGowan's potentially taking over for that, you know, point guard position. And you're starting to actually see the pieces starting to move. And so I think that the basketball program is headed in a good direction. And I think they'll actually be pretty good. But I don't know. I don't know what it looks like 5 years from now.
How many high school kids in the state of Nebraska has Nebraska offered? Who are Hunter Salas, obviously. Who else?
Hunter, they Isaac Trout. They offered Max Morrell, but that wasn't ever going to happen.
Right, but haven't they offered other younger underclassmen?
Not a ton. I mean, I don't think they've offered a ton.
Did they offer any of the other kids from Miller North?
Yeah, Saint doesn't have an offer, but Jason Green does.
Yeah, Jason Green's a good player.
Yeah, he is.
Now, you get Jason in college, and you shave off a little bit of the, you know, high school, whatever. Jason Green's going to be a good player.
Yeah, he is.
He'll put on 15 pounds of muscle and lose 10 pounds of weight.
Yeah. And
So here's my thought. This will be my – and then I'll give you a final thought. Hunter Salas, Jason Green, Isaac Trout, I don't know if there's others. Nebraska needs to get some of those guys. They need to get them. Like, don't – if you're offering them and you want them, then sooner or later you got to get somebody. Now, I'm not saying you're going to get Hunter Salas. That's going to be a tough pull. North Carolina's in, Gonzaga's in, Kansas is in. Iowa State has done a really good job. So has Nebraska. Nebraska's recruited him well. But you can almost understand if Hunter Salas doesn't pick Nebraska. In fact, you can understand it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. He's probably going to spend 2 years at college and then go to the NBA. He may want to spend those 2 years at North Carolina. I get it. But you start offering kids in state and you don't get any of them, that's a problem. Nebraska basketball has to get kids from the state of Nebraska if Nebraska basketball thinks those kids are good enough to play at Nebraska. And if Nebraska is offering kids in this state that they think are good enough to play here, then they should want those kids and they should get those kids, at least some of them. Because sooner or later, your program has to be defined by the best player in your state who's also good enough to play for you, wants to play for you. That's how you get good. That's how you get good. You do not get good with every single kid who's good enough to play for you in the state going somewhere else. They have to want to come play for you at some point. And I'm not saying that Fred isn't going to get those guys. In fact, I think they probably will. But I'm saying that at some point, you have to get the players who are good enough in your state to play for you. I give you an example. Missouri basketball fell apart over 10, 12 years, in large part because the guys that were good enough to play for Missouri that Missouri also wanted did not play for Missouri. Tyler Hansbrough didn't play for Missouri. Jeremy Beal didn't play for Missouri. A bunch of other guys didn't play for Missouri. They played at schools other than Missouri. Who's the kid that the kid that went to Kansas? I can't remember his name.
Ben McLemore?
Yeah. Also didn't play for Missouri. Mm-hmm. The kid, and Missouri's got a much better basketball history than Nebraska. So, granted, Missouri's done better over the last 10 years than Nebraska has. But the point is, you got to get the kids. And if Tim had a flaw, the kids were good enough to play at Nebraska. They didn't play at Nebraska.
Here's what I'd say. First off, I have quite a few thoughts and that compliment you. One, this is something that's been talked about since literally the 60s. You go back and this has been talked about in Nebraska basketball for decades and decades and decades. Two, I think Tim was starting to set himself up to get all these kids from the state. They were going to get Donovan. They were going to get they're probably going to get Chucky. I mean, I shouldn't say that as a proclamation, but I think that they were going to start getting these kids. I think they had a really good chance at Chucky. I think they actually had a really good chance with Hunter,
right,
with Tim. And that was something
about Doc when he left. Well, Doc was going to get a Koya gal.
Sure. Yeah. But what I'm saying,
when they were there,
but I think he was starting to figure out that was important. Right. I mean, Michael Lewis, the assistant coach,
was
a huge Chucky fan.
Okay.
Huge.
Fair enough.
Still recruiting Hunter Salas to this day, from UCLA.
Everybody is. He's good.
They were starting to figure out that needed it. Now it happened too late.
Yeah.
With that being said, too, I had a coach call me once and ask, why is Nebraska not recruiting Chucky? And I think part of the reason is they feel like they have their point guards and they all have this figured out. And the coach was like, who cares? Who cares if they have whatever? This kid's in your backyard. He's going to play in the Division I basketball. He's going to be a really good point guard. And this is something that happened when they were in Iowa as well. They didn't recruit the state of Iowa that well. However, they didn't care because they ended up getting these transfers and they won. And there's a certain element of, if you win, then they don't really care how the sausage is made. At the same time, though, there is something about this state in particular. My theory is, which I don't think it's that off base, based on the walk-on program from the 70s and 80s and 90s for football, there is an infatuation with in-state kids, more so than a lot of thoughts of other states. And there is a correlation where if you get these in-state kids, you're going to be better.
Right.
Now, the thing is now that actually is pretty true now, because you get Hunter, he's starting for you first game. You get Chucky, I think Chucky, I'd have a hard time not playing Chucky a lot next year.
Right.
I think Max Morrell, who's going to Stanford, I thought that kid was a hell of a player.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's why, you know, Tim was starting to take Brady Hyman and a Cola Rope, and you're starting to recruit all these kids, is once you start that pipeline and then you start winning, then you're going to get the Hunter's Houses of the world that pop up in your backyard. Right. I think that that's a really, it's really interesting, because it was the same thing at Iowa when they were at Iowa State. They didn't recruit it great, but they got flack for it, but they won, so it didn't matter. Here, I think even if you do win, there's going to be this sense of, well, you could have won more if you got this player, because
if they, you know, they've done it again. We have pretty good insight on their work on Hunter Salas. I think we know quite a bit about the recruitment of Hunter Salas, Chris. Mm-hmm. They've done a great job with Hunter. It just may not be enough because, you know.
Kansas, it's a different ballgame whenever you start bringing in.
Five-star. It's not the same conversation. Harrison Barnes didn't go to Iowa State because he went to North Carolina. The problem that Iowa State made, i.e. Greg McDermott, is not recruiting his own son. Well, he says he didn't want to add his son to the program because he didn't have the atmosphere or the environment or whatever. But at the end of the day, they didn't get Doug either. So I'm sure, you know, like that kind of sucked too. How much better would Fred Hoiberg's team spend with Doug? Oh my God.
He would have been their first year. They would have been.
Oh my God. Good. They would have went to the Final Four.
That would have been really good. But to your point, though, I mean, the in-state talent in Nebraska, particularly in Omaha, is getting so much better than it was even 5-10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So once you start kind of – and that's why, you know, I believe it's Armon Gates is kind of the in-state guy, and you get some inroads for some guys, and you start winning, it's going to be so much easier to pick these guys off from the Wisconsins and the North Carolinas even, because you're winning and why wouldn't you want to go down there? Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be an interesting dynamic with basketball the next couple of years. I think still, you know, Fred, I think has a, I don't know if he'd quite admit this, but I do think he has a chip on his shoulder with everything that happened in Chicago. I think he wants to prove that it wasn't a fluke at Iowa State. I think he wants to win in the Big Ten. I think he won in the Big 12 and he wants to prove he can win in the Big Ten. We kind of talked about this. He's pretty buttoned up. He's pretty quiet. He's pretty, you know, composed, but this is going to sound weird, but whenever they would lose and they would lose maybe in a close one, or, you know, he really wanted a game for whatever reason, when he walked off the podium into the locker room, like there were times, because I would follow him to go up to the press box to write, and there were times when he would like hang back and he'd like say hi to his wife, and you know, he would maybe say hi to me or other reporters and then kind of go off the locker room, and you know, he was kind of more reserved. There were some games when he like sprinted, basically like speed walked to that locker room, which told me that he was like, he's angry, there's a want there because he wants to prove that he can win, that he's one of the best coaches in college basketball. And that is going to drive the program, and that's what's going to drive him. And I think that he wants to try some new things out, and he wants to, this is a 10-year NBA guy that could have played even longer. And this is a guy that played, you know, is one of the best ever players in the state of Iowa. Yes, there's a competitive drive there that lurks underneath that I don't think you see, because he's not like Tim and he doesn't show you everything. So that's a good thing to have, because even though, like I said, it's almost like he's on loan, but he wants to prove something. And that's as good of a combination as you want or as you can get for kind of the future of your program.
We're going to end it there, Chris. I think that's great insight. People will eat that up. We're going to miss you on basketball, man. Fred Hoiberg is probably like, so who am I talking to now? So, like, you know, there's been a lot, you know, Fred's going to miss you. We're going to miss you. We're going to miss you in general. I'm going to miss you covering football. Yeah,
it's good. I'm going to miss you guys a lot too. I'm going to miss you guys a lot. You don't often get to work with your friends, and that's something that I got really lucky with, is being able to work with you guys. And you guys have been such great mentors to me as reporters and as husbands and as fathers. And I hope people know how good you guys are at heart. And I hope that people appreciate the empathy that you guys bring to your coverage and how much thought you put into it. And I mean, readers are so lucky to have you two and Dirk and Tom, and to have Thad as an editor. Like, it's so hard to leave.
We're very lucky for Thad.
So, yeah, we are.
It's hard to lose you.
So I appreciate everything you guys have done for the Rask fans. I know that I, you know, may ruffle your feathers every now and then by not saying that everything is great and not believing that every recruit's great. I will go down that my worst take is, you know, is Waldo Robinson that good, or is he Tyshawn Lindsey? That was about a year ago and that didn't age well. But I mean, people, I appreciate everybody that's read anything that I've ever written ever. There's no reason for you to ever have done that. And it's weird because, you know, I've lived in this state since I was, you know, 18, and to go from 18 to 27, I mean, that's a lot of my adult life. Like I was thinking earlier, when I turned 27, I was like, wow, I feel like I was just 17. And a lot of that time has been spent in this state. And so I think over the next, you know, 40 years, wherever I am, I'll always think back on like growing up and becoming an adult in the state of Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And so I've always appreciated Nebraskans and their passion and their thoughts and their kindness and, even their snark. It's been really fun. So I hate leaving, but I also am really excited about the future.
You did 18 to 27 a hell of a lot better than I did, Chris. Most people don't do 18 to 27 as well as you did. Evan probably did.
Oh, Evan for sure did.
But Evan's a left-keeled kind of guy. I didn't do 18 to 27 worth of shit.
I don't know. I don't know who's going to make fun of all my road trip meals and.
I do that.
You're not as pointed as Chris is.
Well, the difference. I mean, tell you what.
Fair enough. Here's the funny thing. The last thing here. Chris has ability to comment or get at Evan in ways that I cannot. Because I'm too stupid. I'm too absurd. And I'm too much of an idiot. I can't do it quite the way Chris can. Chris said something about Evan doing something out of left field, and it unnerved Evan for about 23 seconds. It's the only time I've ever seen Evan flapped. He was briefly flapped. There was a flap, and then then he went back to unflappable. He was flapped briefly.
When you do it, Sam, it's kind of like a cat trying to play with a mouse. Like, ooh, I wonder if I can get a reaction here. With Chris, it was like he seriously couldn't fathom whatever it was.
Evan, when we go to a bar at midnight in Iowa City on a Thursday and I get a whiskey and you get a sangria, it's a layup, homie. Like, it's a layup. Like, that's so – that doesn't – Sangria is like 7 o'clock at a beach cabana. Like, so sangria is not midnight on a Thursday after 3 days of reporting.
It's not a regular thing.
I'm going to miss. I'm going to miss that Chris's ability to flap, Evan.
See, I just, you know, whatever. It's refreshing. I'm not going to put up appearances. So I'm going to have a, you know, whatever you're having.
And I appreciate about it. It's not, I'm saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying.
But he's getting it now. And I don't understand how you're able to do this. It's a gift.
I guess.
That I don't have because, again, I'm too stupid and absurd. I can't. And he just has the ability to get under Evan's skin and flap him. We need to find when we hire Chris's replacement, and I hope we're able to do that. We need to find somebody who can flap Evan. That'll be part of the test. Can you flap him?
Just put the two in a room for like 60 seconds, and then see how Evan goes.
Yeah,
I think that's the.
He comes out and says, "Look, I got to be honest, I got flapped." And we know.
Sometimes it's hard to be the teacher teaching a guy when the student's belligerent and thinks he knows. Okay.
Well, thanks for everybody for listening. Chris will miss you. You know that.
Yeah. Thank
you. I miss you guys too.
But the podcast will have your presence again this fall. There's no reason why it can't because it's a Zoom meeting.
Sure.
You can Zoom in with us and we may just call you up again because we're not getting paid to do this anyway.
Yeah. Right? Call me whenever.
Listening. Give Chris a note of thanks. He's been such an asset for us in the last 3 years. Until next time, which is next week. This is the Pick Six Podcast. See you guys.